The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Free Library. I'm Sarah Goddard. I'm the Assistant Director of the Lecture Series here. Before we get started, please take a moment to turn off your cell phones. And I just wanted to remind everybody that we'll have a book signing upstairs with our author in the lobby immediately following the presentation down here. So please join us for that. Our author tonight, Azara Nafisi, returned to her native Iran after a long education abroad in both the U.S. and England and remained there for some 18 years. She taught English literature at the University of Tehran from 1979 to 1981 when she was expelled for refusing to wear the veil, and later at the Free Islamic University and Alameh Tabatabai in Tehran. In 1997, Ms. Nafisi and her family left for the United States, and she now teaches at Johns Hopkins University. For 2 years before she left Iran, she conducted a private weekly class in her home, where a handful of her best female students would lay down their veils to discuss books. In her book, Reading Lolita in Tehran, Nafisi presents her class as an oasis where her girls find relief, pleasure, passion, and salvation in the imaginative worlds of Austin, Fitzgerald, James, and Nabokov. The women, who at first were suspicious of one another and afraid to speak their minds, soon opened up and began to express their dreams and disappointments as they responded to the books that they were reading. As noted by many reviewers, this book transcends categorization as memoir, literary criticism, or social history, though it is superb as all three. The story reflects the oppression of the Iranian regime, as well as the women's determination not to be crushed by it. Each author is cast in a new light, showcasing, for instance, The Great Gatsby against the turbulence of the Iranian Revolution, or how her students see Daisy Miller as Iraqi bombs fall into Tehran. Nafisi's Iran, with its omnipresent slogans and morality squads, recalls the totalitarian worlds from earlier works of literature, like Orwell's 1984 or Atwood's The Handmaid's Tale. Reading Lolita in Tehran, which is newly out in paperback and is back on the New York Times bestseller list this week. She's here to share her story with us tonight. Please join me in welcoming Azara Nafisi.
Thank you so much. How wonderful. Thank you so much. It's such a, please don't make me cry. let me sort of retain an ounce of dignity. It is a great pleasure to be here. Although these lights are sort of competing, do we have to have these lights here? Is it torture? Is it reminding me of my experiences back home? thank you. It's a great pleasure to be here, and I hope that the best part for me is the part where we'll be talking and exchanging ideas, and I hope that we'll have time to do that. And so I hope that somebody in the back from the library would sort of make frantic gestures and not let me run away with my captive audience. I don't want to do that, although it is really fun to have people captive. I wanted to begin, in fact, with something that I find myself doing more and more, but I think that this one sentence from Vladimir Nabokov explains so much of what I want to share with you tonight and what I think that at least my book is partly about. There's a sentence by him, and I think he mentioned that to his students in his Russian literature class. He says that readers are born free, and they ought to remain free. And, you know, ever since I returned to Iran, I've been thinking about the right of readers. We usually think about writers, and writers are privileged creatures. In countries like mine, if a writer is jailed or denied his or her freedom of speech, at least we make gestures and we let the government know about our displeasure. But what about millions of readers? What about their right to read freely and to be able to publicly and freely share their interpretations, because I think works of literature and art are like hothouse flowers. They need constant interpretation. They need a constant exchange between those who read and those who write. And if one side dries up, for the other side, it becomes very difficult to communicate. So what I wanted to do tonight was, in fact, do what I think my book is about. It is obviously celebration of great works of literature and great writers, but more than anything else, it's a celebration of the act of reading, something that we a lot of times forget. And side by side with that, it is a celebration of just the act of living. You know, it is so easy, especially in the world today, to get caught in big ideas. You know, we all talk about democracy. We talk about human rights. But we seldom pay attention to the details which go to make these worlds meaningful. I mean, we seldom nowadays ask ourselves, why do people give their lives in order to, you know, reserve their right to write and read the way they want to? So what I thought is important, and I remember another favorite writer of mine, the Polish, very eccentric writer whom I absolutely am in love with, Witold Gombrowicz, in his diaries, he talks about it is easy to sacrifice small details in the name of great ideals. And I think that it is those details which literature and art bring into focus for us. They sort of pass over and negate and deny generalizations, and they go to the heart of the matter. They bring to life those small, what one of my students, the youngest student in this book, Yasi, called the blacklisted details. She wrote a poem about all the things that she wanted to do, like ride a bicycle like her male cousin, wear a coat that is colorful, like orange and red, and to be able to, you know, enter the same door at the university as the men did, because women were segregated, you know, in terms of entering doors at universities. They would go through these small holes where they would be examined for weapons of mass destruction, which would be sort of lipstick and... I was telling my friends last night that I really owe the wearing of lipstick to the Islamic Republic. It sort of became a statement. But at any rate, she was talking about all these details of life that she, as a 20-year-old, wanted to enjoy. And she called all of these the blacklisted details. And I wanted to talk about these blacklisted details and a celebration of these details. And the fact that more than any other form, literary form, I think the novel celebrates these details. And I think that the message of the novel, if it needs to have a message, is that we all need a form of democratic imagination. And by a democratic imagination is a form of imagination that allows spaces for other voices, that allows other voices to participate without fear of those voices and without the desire to eliminate them. So that is why, you know, I wanted to sort of talk with you or to you tonight. I hope I won't talk at you. But at any rate, so if I'm going to be limiting my talk to some of my own experiences in this book, it is not because I think that I'm an absolutely extraordinary people and I need to get all these intelligent people in one room to talk about myself, but because I believe with the premise of the novel that there is no ordinary individual. That in fact, what the novel basically does, it turns what seems to be ordinary lives into extraordinary. And it is the discovery of that stranger in you, of that extraordinariness of ordinary life, which makes novel such a miracle. It is not like epic or romance about great heroic deeds. The heroes are people who don't know they're heroes. And so if you bear with me, I would like to sort of go over... I'm not going to read from the book. I think anybody who... I mean, I read two or three paragraphs here and there, but I think anybody who likes to read this book will read it. You know, you don't need to be read by me, you know. This is more a dialogue rather than, you know, me satisfying my whatever ego that has been left me. But at any rate, So what I wanted to then sort of fill in the gaps in these chapters, and that would be sort of a background for the kind of discussion we will have. And I tell you that a lot of people tell me, why Lolita? You know, especially actually in this country, in Iran, nobody asks me why Lolita, you know? I mean, they might take you to jail for Lolita, but they don't ask you why Lolita. But over here, people look at you, you know, what's wrong with you, woman, you know? And one interviewer told me that his wife didn't dare read Lolita in the New York subway. Now, what kind of a place New York subway has become, I don't know. I only watch Law and Order, so that is my view of New York subways, but God knows. But at any rate, this central question of why Lolita, I would like to come back to this question because I think it is very central to some of the ideas that I would like to share with you tonight. But could you just wait? I will skip Lolita, go to Gatsby, and then come back to Lolita and tell you why Lolita as far as I'm concerned. Now, the Gatsby chapter begins with, well, anyway, the point about Gatsby is that I left Iran when I was very young. I was about 13, and everybody almost who was in that airport, I think, remembers that I was the 13-year-old brat who was running around Tehran airport saying, I don't want to leave. I really, really made a scene. I was crying, running, didn't want to go. They finally sort of caught me, you know, handcuffed me, put me in the plane on my way to England. And ever since that moment when the door closed on me and when I left the Tehran airport, the idea of home, the idea of Iran became the focus of my life. And all those years that I spent away from home, I had created in my mind a set of values and ideas and images which always ended up in Iran. And all I had, of course, was a set of memories and literature. That was the time when I began sort of piling books, and at that time it was mainly Persian poetry. One of my favorite classical poets, Hafez, and then one of the modern poets, Furugh Farrokhzad, I would put them by my bedside and I would just open them at random and read them. So from that early age, the idea of home, and consciously, and I didn't know it then, became symbolized in, you know, a set of words and memories. When in 1979, I finally, you know, the summer of 1979, I got my degree, and I immediately, about 2 days after I passed my orals, I was on the plane on the way to Iran, and I always tell people that my timing is terrible. I mean, I went back to Iran in 1979 to fundamentalism, terror, and the war with Iraq. And in 1997, when I returned to U.S., I came to fundamentalism, terror, and the war with Iraq. So I really suggest to you not to go where I go. Like, for example, right now, I would suggest you go to Berlin, Paris, even London, God knows. But you know, don't stay here as long as I'm here. So, at any rate, immediately, as soon as the plane landed and I got off the plane, I realized that home was not home. Now, the idea of home not being home, and I think I can say this in this country more than any other country, because this country in many ways is still so much, its past is so close to it, that it still has a living relationship with its past, with its revolutionary past, and I hope it does anyway. But the idea of home at times becomes really dangerous because it makes you feel smug. It creates a set of formulas. It makes you feel too much at home and too relaxed. And I think that is really dangerous. And actually, that is what transgressive novels like Lolita do. They make you feel not at home in your own home. And I think that this is a very useful thing. I usually tell my students about a sentence from Theodor Adorno when he says that the highest form of morality is not to feel at home in your own home. And I think that most of the ideologues, most of the people who see the world only through their own lenses and through their own eyes are those people who are too smug and too at home in their own home. So in that sense, I owe this restlessness partly to the Islamic Republic, because it immediately showed me that this wasn't home. And it immediately turned me into a vagabond, into my own, in within the confines of my own homeland. And it immediately forced me to ask questions, not just about the world, but about myself. And that, again, is, I think, another lesson that the novel teaches us, that you don't question the world unless you question yourself. You have to pose yourself as a question mark. And novel after novel, whether comedy or tragedy, whether it is Richardson's Clarissa or Fielding's Tom Jones or Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice or Saul Bellow's Dean's December, you go back to this idea that the protagonist has a flaw, that the plot is usually around this protagonist's journey of discovery, and part of this discovery, or his or her discovery of the world, comes through her discovery of her own flaws. And that, I think, is an amazingly important lesson of the novel, to feel ironic and to feel critical of the self. And I think that is how conscience is born, you know. Conscience is not born out of just criticizing others, which is such an easy thing to do anyway, but out of criticizing the self. So this is what the Islamic Republic did to my country. It made us question who we were. Because if we were not these people who had now usurped power, then who were we? And if we were not them, then how did we allow them to rule us, to become the elite within our country? And I think that this is a question that we're still trying to respond to. But the other part of home not being home was more pragmatic and concrete. And that was the fact that a power had come to my country that said that everything that people like me was, and there were, believe it or not, millions of people like me living in that country, it now said that the way I looked, the way I walked, the things I believed in, the books I read, the way I associated with people, the values I had believed in, all of these were alien. That they did not belong to this culture, to this tradition, to this history, that they were all products of what, of course, now we all know it has become a cliche, the great Satan. That, you know, whoever even looked the way I did was now an alien entity. And that was, again, another question which I had to, you know, discover. And this, at this point, I want to pause, and I hope that we will discuss this during the discussion session, because right now the world is facing what we call Islamism or Islamic fundamentalism. And no matter who you are or where you come from, whether you're going to vote for Dean or whether you are a neocon or whether you are this and that, you still are going to face this question of, you know, Islamism and how to deal with it. Now, one of the things that happened, and unfortunately I see it in the West, is that a set of stereotypes were created, especially with the Islamic Republic. Iran is a very sophisticated society, and it is a society that its Islamists formulated many of the theories around cultural determinism and Islamism that we hear about now. For example, before the Islamic Republic, we would not call these countries all Muslim. We would call them by their names. Turkey, Iran, Afghanistan, Saudi Arabia, Malaysia, Indonesia, countries that came from vastly different cultures and traditions. They were much more different from one another than France and Germany are. But yet you do not call Europe Christian countries. But you call all of these countries Muslim countries, which simplifies things. Which tells you that all of these Muslims, and experts do, within universities. Which tells you then that all these Muslims are homogeneously like a mass who believe in certain things, and they are of course culturally determined. And under the guise of respecting them, and it's really interesting, from Samuel Huntington in his Clash of Civilizations to people on the left all say the same thing about this, that these people by culture are determined, and this is the way they want it, that Muslims are different from the rest of us. So once this myth is created, it is very easy to close your eyes to the atrocities that happen in these countries because it's their culture. If we tell them that we don't like women to be stoned, we are imposing our own values upon them. This is so bloody insulting. It is so insulting to the women who are being stoned to say that they enjoy being stoned, you know. And it is insulting to a culture that has created Ibn Sina, Ibn Rushd, Ibn Arabi, Jalaluddin Rumi, Hafiz, that has brought you many aspects of science like algebra. It is very insulting to that culture to say that it is its most important aspect is reducing the age of marriage from 18 to 9, which is what these people did. Those people who tell me why Lolita, I think they should perhaps ask these people why, lower the age of marriage to 9, why stone people to death for what they call adultery and prostitution, while you legalize not only polygamy but temporary marriage, where you can marry a woman, you can rent a woman by the hour, and yet you stone women to death calling them prostitutes. Women on the witness stand are considered as half men. That is why women cannot become judges. Shirin Ebadi, the Nobel Prize winner, used to be a judge, one of the first women judges in Iran, and after the revolution, of course, she was disrobed. I mean, no woman could be judged because women are supposedly weak and they cannot judge. They don't have that capacity to judge, a problem that we are now facing in Afghanistan with that shameful constitution that has been ratified right now. But at any rate, so the point about it is that these were all imposed upon our society, and what I would like you to consider before I move on is two things. One, this is not merely about religion. All religions have aspects which are very reactionary. We don't say that people in Massachusetts love burning witches, do we? I mean, we don't say that it used to be their culture. We rather talk about Hawthorne and Melville and Thoreau rather than that. We rather think that the culture of the South, the aspects that should be preserved, would be Faulkner and Carson McCullers and its wonderful Southern writers, rather than thinking that slavery was a culture that should have been kept. And you know that in Richmond, Virginia, they disagreed with bringing the statue of Lincoln there because they said that Lincoln offended their sensibilities, So what people have a right to disown aspects of culture which is inhumane, which is terrible. They have a right. They are not condemned by their culture. Inquisition should not have become the shining aspect of European culture. So you admire people when they fight, when they withstand and stand up to, these reactionary aspects of culture. That is, one aspect of it. And the other aspect of it, I promise you, no woman likes to be flogged for not wearing the veil properly. Because in confiscating the individual rights of Iranians or of Saudi Arabians or all the other people to act the way they want to, they also confiscated the right to freedom of worship. Not only did they take away the right of atheists and Christians and Jews and Baha'is and the Zoroastrians, but they also took away the right of Muslims to worship the way they want to. Muslims, like Christians and Jews and Baha'is, they have different interpretations of their religion. And they would like to, actually today I had an interview with Marty Moskowitz, and a man came, one of the people who called in was from Africa. And he said, why do people think that, Muslims act all the same way? And he was saying that in Africa, we don't wear head covering, but we still are Muslims. He was bringing up this issue that every Muslim, like every Christian or every Jew, has the right to worship the way he wants to. And there were many people in my country, actually many of the grand ayatollahs, who objected to religion becoming the state because they said this takes away the right of Muslims to be the way they are, and because then people would blame everything on religion. The veil was imposed upon the Iranian people as part of an ideology. This was a religion that was confiscated, and it imposed a uniformity It imposed a uniformity upon the citizens, and it became a means of control in the same manner that in the Soviet Union they were also talking about Western cultural invasion. If you've seen that wonderful film Ninochka with Greta Garbo, where she's a Soviet functionary, goes to Europe and falls in love with this man. Anyway, she takes some lingerie with her back to Soviet Union, and she's washing her lingerie, and her roommate tells her, Ninochka, this is against the state. And she says, I don't want my lingerie to undermine the state. Now, this was the way things were in the Soviet Union. The best, not the worst, but the best aspects of Western culture, that was individual freedoms, the right to free speech, the right to, choice, these were objects of attack, not colonialism or imperialism the way you and I see it. And of course, in communist China, you remember the Mao jackets and women not wearing makeup and all of that. So all of these totalitarian societies, the first thing that they do at the heart of their system is confiscation of individual rights. And confiscation of individual rights becomes legitimate under the guise that, you know, it is culturally or traditionally bound. Now, in my country, and I'm coming very close to why, Lolita, do I have 5 more minutes or how much? 10. Wow. What am I going to do with this? Thank you. The whole point here, and I lost the thread of, is that, God, what was I? What? Why Lolita? Okay, I'm coming back to why Lolita in 2 seconds, actually. But the whole point of when they imposed, and it was mentioned that I was expelled from University of Tehran at the beginning of the 80s for refusing to wear the veil. In fact, many women were expelled from their jobs at that time. The Islamic government for over a year tried to impose the veil, and women very much objected to it. Hundreds of thousands of women came out in demonstrations. They threw acid into their faces. They attacked them with knives and with scissors, and they wouldn't give in. There were sit-ins, there were protests, until they saw no other choice but make it first mandatory in workplaces, then they made it mandatory in shops, then they made it mandatory in streets where Toyota patrols with 2 gunned men and women would patrol the streets of Tehran. They were called the morality squads. They called themselves the blood of God. I think God should rebel against the way his or her or its name is being used. At any rate, that was when they forced the women. I mean, women had no other resource but wearing the veil. And that was an insult to those women who wore the veil, because those women chose to wear the veil because they believed it. And now that I was forced to wear it, I would negate her belief, and both of us would become a lie. Of course, these are the things that experts and politicians over here seldom talk about. So now I come to why Lolita. I never had any doubt in my mind, but I have to tell you that none of my students, or I, questioned Lolita either, the way it is being questioned in the West. The very first page of Lolita, Humbert tells you that Lolita had a precedence, that he fell in love with a young girl when he was 13, and that girl, Annabel Lee, an allusion to Edgar Allan Poe, died, and he could never fulfill that love, the love was not consummated. And ever since then, Humbert wants to turn every little girl that he sees into that lost love. And when he sees Lolita, he captures her, and he says that I wanted to keep Lolita on that island of entranced time. He wants to stop time, and he wants to impose his dream upon Lolita's living reality. And this, according to Nabokov, and in novel after novel, he comes back to this theme, is the biggest crime: to impose your dream upon someone else's reality, to deprive them of their potential for being. We'll never know what Lolita would have been. And it doesn't matter what Lolita would have been. I don't mean that Lolita would have been another Toni Morrison or Einstein. Lolita could be just a vulgar woman like her mother. But she had the right to be that. And blindness, as in The Great Gatsby, as in Jane Austen, blindness towards others lack of empathy and compassion towards other human beings, imposition of your own desires and dreams and visions upon others in novel after novel becomes the highest crime. Now, for us living in the Islamic Republic, this was a very easy conclusion to reach, because we had a set of people who had turned us, especially the women, into figments of their imagination. And so we immediately bonded with Nabokov. Having said that, I don't think we should read books in order to find moral or political or social messages in them. One of the most important things about the act of reading is the pure and adulterated sensual joy of reading. The pleasure, the appreciation that a human being can weave a world out of nothing, the closest thing to the act of creation. And that is what we should enjoy and celebrate. But there are bonuses, because they give you meaning after meaning, level after level of pleasure and of discovery. So, you know, I'm not saying go and find all these, you know, little messages in Lolita. But the important thing is that Lolita, in the same manner as my students and the women living in Iran, were never seduced by Humbert. Lolita, from the moment he seduces her, she knows what he's done to her. And she's constantly reminding her, and she's constantly trying to escape from her. And like my students, she has nowhere to go. That is what he says, that she came crying into my arms in the last turn because she had nowhere to go. And that is the worst thing that a totalitarian mindset can do to you, to implicate the victim in the crime that is being committed against her, to stain her with his crime. And that is how we felt every morning when I left home and I had to, as T.S. Eliot says, put on the face to meet the faces that I meet, a face that wasn't mine. I felt dirty, and I felt like a liar, and I felt like a coward. And yet, what else do you do? So, in order, and I want to now reach my conclusion, I didn't go over this, actually to come out of this intensity, I just wanted to tell you also that, of course, the main subject of attack in countries like this becomes imagination, because there's nothing you can do to imagination. You cannot handcuff it, you cannot create walls around it, and it becomes very dangerous, and people living under these pressures, as people who were living in Stalin's or Hitler's concentration camps, I mean, people keep thinking, how come Primo Levi, and not just Primo Levi, all these other just ordinary people who were taken to concentration camps were reading poetry to one another? Why were they quoting Madame Bovary to one another? Because when you are deprived of every ounce of individual dignity and integrity, when they take everything away from you and all the choices away from you, all that you are left with is the highest points of achievements of individuals, the highest points of uniqueness and originality, and that, of course, is works of art and works of imagination. And that is why people instinctively, under periods of deprivation, turn back to these works the way a thirsty man turns to water. And that is why I think that my students in Iran, as people in Eastern Europe or in Hitler's Germany or in other parts of the world where they suffer similar systems, they act the same. They turn back to achievements of humanity to regain that sense of individual dignity. And so these people become very vicious in terms of the works of art. And, you know, I mentioned this in my book, that they cut Ophelia from Hamlet. And they cut most Desdemona from most scenes of Othello. And in the best Soviet tradition, they cut the suicide scene from Othello because they said the masses will be demoralized by suicide, you know. And this was the first time that Iago went scot-free. I mean, you wouldn't know why this poor guy is being murdered. You know, what is the reason? So this was a new interpretation of Othello. In children's book, and I have one of them during the book signing, I can show it to you. In children's books, they put scarves on female chickens. I don't know how they could tell the sex of the female chickens, because the male chickens looking at the females might go absolutely wild and do unspeakable things. Of course, I would like the gentlemen in this room think of how insulting this is to them, that just one strand of our hair would just drive you, you know, absolutely crazy. And tell me that this form of interpretations of a great religion, is it not an insult to that religion? A religion that has produced scientists and philosophers and thinkers to be reduced now to a bunch of, you know, hooligans, men who cannot control their urges if they see a strand of a woman's hair. And tell me how strong a woman becomes. You are a victim, but you're so powerful. And this is the power that the Iranian women used by going into the streets and not complying and being flogged and taken to jail and again going into the streets and not complying. And finally forcing the morality squads to retreat rather than they retreating. And that is why Iran today is such a dynamic and vibrant society. It is not because of its religious elite. It is because of the society which refused to comply, which found subversive and non-violent ways of confronting this phenomena by just being themselves, by celebrating the best things that individual can bring to life. So I would now just want to come to the end. I'm afraid I didn't talk about the good things like Gatsby and James, and they hated James. They hated his ambiguity. Couldn't stand him. What is this guy talking about? I mean, this bloody Daisy Miller deserves to die. You know, why is she, you know, why is he making us feel ambivalent about her? And I want to end, and what I wanted to tell you is that today, of course, in Tehran, I know that many people, especially in the poorer areas of Iran, are watching forbidden satellite dishes, and they are watching also both the best and the worst of this culture. In 1996, David Hasselhoff claimed that Baywatch was the most popular show in Tehran. People were buying satellite dishes and selling tickets to the bold and beautiful. And Baywatch, things that I've never seen until I went to Iran, you know. But the point about it is that side by side with Baywatch, they're also discussing Hannah Arendt and Karl Popper and the Declaration of Human Rights and actually your Declaration of Independence. And my students in Iran knew more about de Tocqueville than my students in U.S. know about him. So this is, of course, part of learning how to be democratic, the high and the low. The fact is that you don't censor either. You put on a dialogue and a debate about them to educate people. And I think this is the gift that we bring you. And this is the genuine exchange of cultures. That Austin and James and Bello, and of course I just discovered Zola Neale Hurston when I came to U.S. and now I'm now teaching here alongside of Jane Austen. The gift is that these golden emissaries, these are the real emissaries of this culture who go to other cultures, and we give you back the gift when we reinterpret your Zora Neale Hurstons and your Alice Walkers and your Henry Jameses and your Mark Twains. And we reassert the values. We remind you that life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness cannot possibly be geographically or culturally determined. That it does not belong to one single land in the same way that algebra cannot be geographically determined. And this is the genuine exchange of cultures. And I want to end with Jane Austen, celebration of one of the most democratic novelists I have ever read and one of the most subversive. At the center of each Austen novel, there is a woman who says no to the authority of her parents, of her society, welcoming a life of bleak poverty and unhappiness, but saying, I marry the man that I want, and bringing up again and again the freedom of choice. Austen is not about marriage. There are many unhappy marriages in Austen, more unhappy than happy, actually. And the marriage of the hero and the heroine is only two sentences at the end of the novel. Austen is about the process of self-discovery through communication with others, I think, and the question of choice. So I want to end with the last, it's my last chapter in my book. I have an epilogue, but this is the last chapter, and I want to share it with you because this is just a dream, but I wanted to share this fantasy with you, so I want to end it with this, and thank you for being so patient. I have a recurring fantasy, and I have a magician in this book. If you have read it, some of you might have. And this is the day when I went to my magician's house to say goodbye to him. It was my last day in Iran. And this is where the chapter ends. I'm not giving away the ending. No, this is not the kind of book that has an end. I have a recurring fantasy that one more article has been added to the Bill of Rights, the right to free access to imagination. I have come to believe that genuine democracy cannot exist without the freedom to imagine and the right to use imaginative works without any restrictions. To have a whole life, one must have the possibility of publicly shaping and expressing private worlds, dreams, thoughts, and desires, of constantly having access to a dialogue between the public and private worlds. How else do we know that we have existed, felt, desired, hated, feared? That day, when I left my magician's home, I sat on the top steps of the apartment house and wrote these words in my notebook. I dated the entry June 23, 1997, and wrote beside the date for my new book. It took me another year after that day to think again about writing this book, and another before I could bring myself to take up my pen, as the saying goes, and write about Austen and Nabokov and those who read and lived them with me. That day, when I left my magician's house, the sun was fading and the air was mild, the trees a verdant green, and I had many reasons to feel sad. Every object and every face had lost its tangibleness and appeared like a cherished memory. My parents, friends, students, this house, those trees, the withdrawing lights from the mountains in the mirror. But I was also vaguely elated. And to paraphrase Muriel Spark's heroine in her wonderful novel, Loitering with Intent, I went about my way rejoicing, thinking how wonderful it is to be a woman and a writer at the end of the 20th century. Thank you so much for your patience. Thank you. Thank you. Now is the good part. We'll talk.
Now, we have two volunteers in the aisles with microphones, so please do wait for them, and we'll pick some people out.
There's that lady and there's that gentleman.
You have cited ways in which things are getting better in Iran. Recently, the Wall Street Journal reported that the rulers of Iran had disqualified hundreds of candidates for office, including some 80 sitting legislators. My question is, during what time frame do you think that that system is going to change? How do you think that that change is going to come about?
And my God. And are you being absolutely fair? Yes.
And what do you think, what do you want from the United States in terms of either doing something to encourage that type of development or refraining from doing things which would thereby facilitate that kind of development?
I'll begin with the last part of your question. I think that the United States should support the Iranian people's movement in the right way. You know, usually in the political world, especially coming from Washington, it's this either-or. People like to simplify things, you know, reformers, hardliners. No such thing exists in Iran. Iran is a very complicated society, and it cannot be reduced in the fight between reformers and hardliners, and it is really its civil society that is so dynamic that is right now defining these reformers and hardliners. Now, of course, in American politics, we also have the reformers and hardliners. You know, that is how we're talking about them. So I think that U.S. should neither not refrain from supporting the movement, because even if you think about it selfishly, it is in the interest of the American people to have democratic-minded and open societies in those other countries. If they kill and execute their women in football stadiums the way Taliban did, what makes you think that they would not come to bomb New York City and Washington with your own airplanes? the world has become very portable, as Nabokov would say. Both terror and democracy have become portable commodities. And I think that the answer to terror is genuine democracy. Having said that, I don't think that U.S. needs to interfere in the affairs of Iran. I don't think that U.S. government should take sides with any individual or group. I think that it should support the issues that the Iranian people are constantly asking for, and it should genuinely support the human rights of the Iranian people. Any form of dialogue with the Iranian people should be contingent upon demands for the human rights of the Iranians. And this is something that U.S. is inconsistent about. You know, it does one day, one person says one thing, another person says another. So you never know where you stand. I'm glad you mentioned that the fact that I don't know how much you've been following the Iranian news, but recently during the elections, the so-called hardliners or a section of them discredited 85 people who were within the parliament, including Khatami's brother. You know, now I think that this in fact shows how the demands of the Iranian society is creating rifts within the ruling class. That big chunks within the ruling elite in Iran are realizing that this is not working, that they need to take positions which turns them, transforms them from insiders to outsiders. You know, and that is why I said that I was hopeful, because this is a live civil society. Having said that, you never know. I mean, I don't want to be too helpful. And we have to learn from other societies that underwent these transitions. And we also have to learn from a society like Soviet Union. A totalitarian state destroys all the institutions and creates mafia-like groups who, in fact, bring trouble after the transition has been effected. And these are the things that we need to think about. And these are the ways that we can help the Iranian people. You know. Thank you. And remember, Iran is the only country that is using the non-violent model. I mean, this Nobel Prize winner, she came without her veil, which is quite a courageous act, considering where she was going back to. And she said, I believe in democracy, I believe in human rights, and I'm a Muslim. And I think that this act in itself changes the views of who a Muslim is. And Muslims cannot be just suicide bombers who, you know, are so hateful of life and disenchanted that they kill themselves and others. Muslims can be like people, I think our examples should be people like Gandhi or Mandela. Or now I hope Shirin Ebadi will live up to her, you know, to the expectations. And this lady had I'm sorry, you should be doing it.
There's a lady, Devon.
But because she was, I saw her. No, she.
Okay, I have a question. Okay.
You could rebel.
I mean,
yes.
Question my Eastern values, where I came from, and now that I'm in the adopted country for 34 years, U.S. citizen, I really can look at these two countries in a dispassionate way. So I relate to constantly questioning who I am, where did I come from, where I am right now as a U.S. citizen. I'm neither Hindu, nor Christian, nor Muslim. Okay? And my question is this, what can I do to make a difference in this adopted land? When I go from here, what concrete steps, what possible things I can do? I am not as good a writer as you are. I'm okay speaker, but I'm not as good a writer as you are. However, through my office, through my touching other people, through my mind, I do change opinions. I make them think. I don't change them. I make them question. Can you guide me something so that I can make a difference in this world?
Of course I can't guide you. This is so obvious. I think that your own answer was in your question. I mean, I think that you discovered it by defining who you are and what you are. And I think that I used to think that it's terrible that I have these two worlds. And I do feel very much at home in this country. And I felt, where is my home? But now I feel good because you have the best of both cultures. And you know, you can exchange that. And I think that that is one of the best gifts. Look at the writers. I loved Nabokov partly because of what he brought to the English language. I mean, you see the nuances and the lights and shades of his Russian all over the English language. And so he brought an aspect of Russia into English which enriched both cultures. And of course, Salman Rushdie, who comes from India and who had the honor of having a fatwa issued against him by Ayatollah Khomeini, is another writer of how you can incorporate the best of both, how you can have an eye that simultaneously sees the world and the other world. I mean, you need, literature is all about seeing the world through the eyes of that other world, you know. So I think you're rather lucky, and and I think you'll do a lot by being who you are.
Please raise your hands if you have a question. Okay. Go ahead in the middle.
How did your experience as a young girl in the U.S. and England through your education and all affect your reaction to the revolution? And if you hadn't had that experience abroad, would your reaction have been different?
It's very difficult to say that. Of course, you know, many people who never left Iran had reactions which are similar to my, especially my students, of course, none of whom had left, because, and I remember that my first introduction to literature was through my parents, especially through my father. I mean, we were really cultural snobs. We really did judge people based on how many books they read, which is really terrible. But and my first introduction, I think I was 10 or 11, were two Russian and French writers, actually, you know, from Tolstoy to Dostoevsky to Scarlet and Red, Stendhal and Balzac. So I don't remember. I think that that childhood education helped me cope with England and U.S. Because at first when I went to England, it was so lonely. I was the only foreigner there, you know, in my school. And people literally did tell me, do you ride camels? You know, I mean, literally. A part of it was just malice, but they would, you know. And the only thing that kept me going was that portable world of books with which I was familiar before I came to England, you know. But I think that what I'm trying to say is that even if you were not physically in the West, that world was already part of the East, you know. I mean, both the best and the worst live in both parts. The fundamentalists got the worst of the West. They are not genuinely Eastern. They got a lot from the two worst systems in 20th century, Stalinism and fascism. They learned a lot from them. And in the same manner, others, you know, learned about democracy, you know. So this is an exchange between the worst and the best. And I don't know how much I have answered your question. I'll have to think about it when I go home, actually.
There's a gentleman over here.
We read your book about 6 months in our book club, and we had one of the liveliest discussions that we've had in that club. And we've been trying to get you, and I was glad that I heard you on NPR today, and I was able to get some of the book club members to come here. As we read the book, we saw certain aspects that were being portrayed. One was, as a professor of literature, you were trying to tell people how to read a book, not just read the story, but what is the underlying message, what is the author trying to say. Second was that in an authoritarian regime, whether it is in Soviet Union or China or Tehran, people's thinking gets distorted. and normal people stop thinking.
Yeah.
You know, even the men who were not being stoned and not being had the acid thrown were not thinking properly. And the third thing, of course, was the life of the women. Now, which of these aspects was the more important one as you were trying to write this book?
You mean as a teacher, as a, or
As a, you know, you proposed in the chapter that you just quoted about Bill of Rights, including right to imagination, and the third is to portray the life of women and how the Islamic societies so often have, you know, really ruined the lives of many, many women.
Well, first of all, I'm so happy that book. I mean, the best thing about books is that they really connect you to people you want to be connected with. And through this book, I discovered book clubs. And, you know, it is so absolutely wonderful. I had no idea. You know, in one meeting, I was saying that we should have this slogan that book readers of the world unite. You know, you have nothing to lose, you know, but really. And it is wonderful for people to share books without any rewards, but sharing books. So I hope that book clubs in this room would be in touch. I have a website that we have put up, I mean, you know, and I hope that you will be in touch with us through the website and post your ideas and what you think about these ideas. But what you mentioned about imagination and about these women, very, very briefly, I want to refer you to the story of 1001 Nights and Shahrazad. In that story, if you remember, you have a king whose queen betrays her, and then he kills a virgin every night before she has a chance to betray him. And what Shahrazad does, if she went into his domain and chose violence the way he did, that cycle would not end. The king might die, but the violence would remain. So what Shahrazad does, she takes the king into her domain, which is the domain of imagination, the domain of stories, and the private domain. And through telling stories, portrays a world that is filled with color and filled with multiplicity of characters and cures them. What I'm trying to say is that I thought that rather than becoming like your oppressor, and it is very easy to become like your oppressor. I mean, I found myself constantly becoming in my mind as violent as they were in reality, but I really did become that violent. I really wished people's death, you know. Rather than giving into that, you should choose a domain which is different from theirs. A domain which would be your rules, which would speak your language. And for me, people find different ways. For me, that domain was the domain of imagination. And I thought that if I tell the story from my point of view, I have gained some control over that reality. We all have to tell our own stories, and that way we break the cycle of tyranny. A lot of people tell me that I'm political. I'm not. This is an existential fight. And I have no political ambitions and no political affiliations. And I wanted to bring politics into my domain rather than being forced to go into the domain of politics. Thank you.
There's a couple questions right here in the middle.
Oh, would you like to take two or three questions together so that we can end? I mean, you know.
I think we'll just have one more after this one.
Okay.
And then we'll be.
You said before that people in Iran, the regime, really opposed individualism, Western individualism, rather than Western imperialism. Mm-hmm. Still, when you have the imposition of democracy in other culture, mm-hmm. that imposition does not coexist with individualism, the cult of individualism. Mm-hmm. Like, can you respond to that paradox?
Well, of course, you know, I do mention this in my book, and I hate for people to think that this becomes a sort of uncritical appraisal of Western civilization or even Western democracies. more than anything else, I love this idea in Saul Bellow, especially in his More Die of Heartbreak, Dean's December, and Bella Rosa Connection. In Bella Rosa Connection, he talks about two of his characters. He says that they survived the ordeal of Holocaust. Will they survive the ordeals of freedom? And there are genuine ordeals in freedom, and it is very difficult. It is not fun, and it is not something that we just celebrate and, you know, everything will become okay. So this culture, when individualism is driven to its extreme, it can become very selfish, it can become very impersonal. We have problems with mass culture, we have problems with actually censorship. Diane Ravitch's wonderful book, The Language Police, talks about many of these ideas. So these exist. All of these exist. The difference is that in a democracy, if Jerry Falwell comes and talks, I can also talk. So I can put forward my own views. In a totalitarian system, there's only one voice. I think that the most important thing in this, in societies that we call democratic, is the existence of multivocality, which doesn't exist in those cultures. And we should criticize the things that you talk about. That is what novels do, I think, a lot of times. They criticize this atomization of the individuals, lack of community, lack of communication in one sense. But we can't, I think that's a contradiction in terms. We can't impose democracy. Democracy is a process. You learn how, you learn it. You don't impose it.
I just have one more question. There's a lady right here in the purple.
Hi. I'd just like to go back to your book, and this is, by contrast, a rather simplistic question, perhaps. Could you just tell us a little bit more about the magician and why you called him a magician?
In every meeting, that's what.
Well, I'm glad I solved that one.
What can I say? What would you like me to say about that?
Why did you use
the term magician? How did it come about? Well, this is a real guy. I mean, he did exist. My family can attest to that. What interested me in this person was that he was a person who had immense talent and imagination, and also was absolutely eccentric. And after the Islamic Revolution, he literally stopped working because he said that, and he kept saying, "I don't belong to this club." So he said that he would not work, and he created a life in that apartment house of his where he would choose a few individuals who were in different walks of life, mainly related to literature and film and theater, which were his main passions. And he lived by proxy. I mean, some of the best Iranian filmmakers, whose names you would know probably if I tell you, would go to him and ask for advice, or he would go and help in the editing of the films. And that life for me was very interesting, and I call him a magician both in a positive and I don't say negative, but in another sense. I would call him a magician in the positive sense because of his amazing passion for imagination. And he, like Bellow, believed that anything that has ever been imagined can happen at least once. So people would go to him literally with their dreams, and he would make it seem as if it were possible. At the time when I felt I can never leave Iran, at the beginning, my passport was taken away from me, and I thought that I'll never, ever leave. I think he was the only person who constantly told me that this can happen. Let's plan for it, And that plan might have been illusory, but the fact that we could plan for it made it as if it could happen, And on the other hand, well, he was like a magician because in the long run, everything was illusory in one sense. And it hurt me a great deal because of the fact that he would refuse to live, that he would live by proxy, And, of course, he refuses to talk to me, so I communicate with him through a friend, a common friend. to whom he says things, like he mentions things about this book, which fortunately were positive. But she said that now he's planning to go into a small village and, you know, just cut all communications. So, you know, he more seems like a character out of a book than reality. Thank you. Thank you.
Please join us upstairs for the please join us upstairs for the book signing.
I have the photographs of the girls. I can show it upstairs for those who have read it.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.